that should be good.
Oh.
It says creating. All right, I think we should be live now. Cool. Well, welcome. For anybody out there who might find this later, we're chatting tonight with Adrian Garcia Bogliano, best known for, was it Late Phases? Chris, you know these better than I do off the top of your head.
Got me on the spot. All I can think of is Late Phases.
Night of the Wolf, Here Comes the Devil.
Night of the Wolf was the alternative title.
Of Late Phases, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, actually, one of the things that this is an opportunity to talk about is what you've been up to since then. I mean, the last time we talked to you was in April of 2021. The interview was published in July of 21. So that's been, 5 years.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff to talk about. And also, you know, again, for people who might find this later, part of what we're doing here is we've got this whole other podcast called Horror Makes Us Happy, where we interview guests about, you know, everything that they've been a fan of from childhood through adulthood and try to pick out, you know, any kind of common themes and then talk about how those intersect with horror as a genre. And so for you, the thing that we really came to was that there was this common theme of, you know, being right on the precipice of the unknown and you're kind of like peering into that unknown and that moment of tension. And so one of the things that we are looking forward to talking with you about is to see if that has cropped up in any of your work since then, whether or not you've recognized that in any of the media that you've enjoyed. Like, there's all kinds of different stuff we could talk about here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where do you want to start?
Yeah. Well, I can start with where I am right now. Like, I just finished a new movie that we premiered in Rotterdam Film Festival.
Oh, nice.
It was my first time being there, and I'm really excited with, you know, the repercussion, the repercussion that we had from that, you know, first time of showing it to an audience. It was great. It was an amazing experience. I hadn't been in a big festival like this one in quite a while because I made a couple of movies I was doing a bunch of films that were kind of festival darlings in the past decade, and then I made a couple on this decade that were big commercial successes here in Mexico, but they didn't travel that much. So this is, you know, my comeback to the festival circuit, and I'm excited about it. It was, you know, a long time since I had a movie premiering in a bigger festival. I think it was 10 years since Curso Diabolico premiered at Tribeca. It was interesting to go back to that type of experience. You know, it's interesting also, you know, just one thing that I would like to drop there, because it's something that I kind of started to realize in the last few years, that there's a very different experience from making films for, you know, for that smaller but, you know, really cool, awesome genre festival circuit, and doing films like the past two films that I made that were made for, you know, for a very popular audience. Those two films really had a big impact with the people who really consume horror here in Mexico. Mexico is this is numbers that appear in the past few years in, you know, in the mainstream media, that Mexico is supposedly the biggest market in terms of going to theaters to see horror films. It's really big. Like, here there are lots of movies that in other countries are never released on theaters that they release them here.
Nice.
Because they need to have like 2-3 at least horror movies in theaters every week. So it's impressive, you know. We get a lot of you know, movies that are not very good, and also some that are great. But there's a lot of stuff, and the people that go to pay their ticket for watching horror films is a very middle to lower class audience, and you know, it's people who go there to be scared. You gotta scare them, or otherwise they can be a very, you know, tough audience. They were not going to be like, well, but that shot reminded me to The Shining. No, it's like, was I scared, you know, 10 times during this movie or what? You know,
that's interesting. Yeah, it sounds like Mexico is like growing a very large interest in horror, specifically in cinema. So like, two things happen. One, it's just awesome to see lots of people from all walks of life. This sounds like what you were saying was like, you know, it's not just diehard horror fans. You see lots of different people going to see more horror movies than anything else. But also, yes, the second part of it is you kind of got to step up your game, because with the increase in the interest in horror, you're right. They get like, it's harder to scare them, so you have to step it up a little bit.
And I'm sure that this is true also in the US for like certain markets and certain places. Like I kind of figured out here in Mexico City, like, what's the best theater that you have to go to on a Saturday night to see how your movie is playing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a horror film, like, it's like, you know, a specific theater where you go there and you're going to see the actual audience of horror films in Mexico, and they're going to respond or not respond, and your thing is going to, you know, die in the water, and you're going to see it, and it's going to be painful. It's very interesting. And the curious thing is that my last two films, you know, they were very popular. They worked really well in theaters, but they were also named by the Mexican Film Institute. Like they make these kind of, you know, how do you say that, dossiers every year of, you know, what were like the biggest successes or whatever. Like they do all these statistics of Mexican films in general, and it turned out that they realized that my last two films were the more pirated Mexican films in the last
That's first, a metric. That's an important metric.
Yeah, in the first half, in the first half of this decade, which is interesting because all the rest of the pirated films are comedies usually. So these were the only two horror films. They were like number one for like the different periods, 2020 to 2022 and 2022 to 2024. Like the two films were like at the top of the most pirated films. And that gives me an impression also that, you know, there is this, you know, maybe lower class people who don't have an access to go to theaters or whatever, who were like really into these films. So I was pleased, you know, because I got to a point where I got to make these very, you know, much smaller films that were like for these, you know, more specific festivals and specific circuit, and that got to a point where I made a movie that we probably talked about when I was in your podcast, that was Black Circle, the film that I made in Sweden. That was a film that I loved to make, but it was like so specific and so difficult to market anywhere that, you know, to me it was basically like, okay, so I want to move now and do something that it's like for, you know, a bigger audience that people can enjoy. It's not a very cerebral and elevated genre. So that's what I've been trying to do. And this last film is kind of a mixture of both worlds.
Okay. A little bit of visceral, a little bit of cerebral.
Yeah.
It's a good combination.
And this is Talking to a Stranger, I think?
Yeah, that's the movie. I made it with, I don't know if you know her, Gigi Saul Guerrero, who is a really, you know, interesting director. Like, to me, she's like the best director of all the Latin American directors making horror right now. I really admire her as a director, but she's also an actress and a great actress. And, you know, I wanted to work with her, and she's the lead in the film. So
cool. That's awesome. Yeah, I've heard of her before. I don't think I've seen anything that she's directed, but I have seen some of the films she's in.
She's incredible. We got to make each one of us an episode for a TV show that was called La Hora Marcada, which is like a remake of like the biggest horror series that was ever made here in Mexico. In the original one, Guillermo del Toro directed. You know, okay. That's where he started his career. Alfonso Cuarón. Yeah. So they remade it, and they called a bunch of horror filmmakers. I was one of them. Mm-hmm. Gigi was another. The director from Weseda, The Bone Woman, for instance, you know, some other really talented directors. Mm-hmm. And to me, Gigi's episode was outstanding. I was so jealous of, you know, what she did. It was amazing. Yeah. I was like, wow. Yeah.
So it was like an anthology, like several different directors. Was the original show like an Outer Limits kind of thing? It sounds like that, yeah. like a local Mexican
Outer Limits. Yeah, but more horror. You know,
yeah, so more like a local Twilight
Zone. Tales from the Crypt, I would say.
Yeah. Something like that. Cool. That's awesome.
Trying to pull it up here if I can find her on IMDb, but it's my internet connection is slow as shit all of a sudden. I pulled up your IMDb, and actually I didn't see it listed on your IMDb yet, but maybe I was looking in the wrong place.
It's the TV show La Hora Marcada. It's really interesting, and I'm really sad that, you know, this was made for Televisa, which is like the biggest network here, TV network, and they are huge here, but I unfortunately think that they don't do much of like selling their stuff to other, because I think that would have played beautifully on Shudder there in the US or, you know, somewhere else. It was a really, you know, high quality. They hire basically 9, you know, horror filmmakers to do this, so it looks great. Like the original ones, they're very like low budget and old school, and you see you know, a lot of the limitations, even though they're great. I'm not saying
Long ago?
The original? Early 90s. Late 80s, early 90s. So it looks like, you know, TV of that time.
Yeah.
But these ones look like, you know, they're all like little movies, all of them. Mm-hmm. They look great, and, you know, it was a really great experience.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, I found her. I didn't realize you were talking about Gigi. I think she.
I was wondering why you didn't click.
Yeah, I think I was
trying to get her on the show for a while. I
think I was in the middle of typing when he was like trying to do two different things, and it didn't click for me.
No, and she's amazing in the film.
Yeah,
she did an amazing job. That's, you know, it's her first lead role, and she just, you know, really, went all the way with it. Yeah.
Cool. We'll have to check that out. I did see.
Hopefully, it will be soon in some festivals in the US.
Yeah,
cool. Chris, I think you've seen something she did in VHS 85. Have you seen that?
Yes.
That's probably what you're thinking of. Also, The Purge.
Blur together.
What's that?
They all blur together after a while. There have been how many? It's been like 9 VHSs now, I think.
Close to it, if not.
maybe. I think I saw a couple of them. Right? I haven't seen
many. The other ones have been good. Halloween, Beyond. They're pretty good.
Yeah, no. The ones I saw, you know, they were very interesting, but I don't know. I have to say that I'm not a huge fan of the anthology format. Like, there's some that I love. I participated in one in the ABCs of Death.
Yeah, okay.
But I can't say that.
Yeah, that's what you did.
Yeah, that was something. I don't know.
I think which one did you do again?
B is for Bigfoot. It just had a re-release, like, I don't have it right here, a wonderful re-release by Umbrella, like a, you know, definitive edition that they just released.
Which is it a steelbook?
It's like a box, those boxes that Umbrella is releasing, but it has like a book, color, and yeah, a couple of other things that it's really good.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the difficulty not only with anthologies is you're fighting two different battles. Number one, anthologies are always tricky because it's hard to, how can I say this? You can't always be perfect. And so when you've got multiple stories, some are going to land, some aren't. But then there's also the problem of if you're doing a series of anthologies, now you've got the problem of it's the same thing with a series because not every movie in a series is going to land. And so you're kind of fighting both battles.
Yeah, but also like in an anthology movie, my biggest problem is that, you know, I'm not very good. I don't think I'm very good at making short films. Mm. I've tried many times and it's like it's a medium that I feel like I don't really understand it. And there are some other directors that are amazing at that, you know, when they are able to maybe even be better at short films than, you know, feature films.
I can see that.
And the ABCs of Death, there was another thing also that it was like, we all had the same budget, but there were very big differences in terms of, you know, a lot of people really pulled a ton of favors, you know, to do their short films, and a ton of, you know, other, or they put extra money on that. So you had like these very big differences in how each episode looked. That, you know, I think it was kind of, you know, uneven on that. It made some of, you know, mine was like, you know, we made it with that, we paid everybody a little bit, and it looks like, you know, very low budget. Mm-hmm. And then
such was the style.
I'm sorry,
such was the style, though, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, we kind of played by the way that we thought it was going to be. But you can see, like, very huge differences. I don't know if you remember, like, the episode of Ty West, for instance, it was, like, I think one character, and it was extremely small. And then you had some others that had, like, you know, tons of CG and really weird shit that they pulled.
It has been a while since I've seen the ABCs of Death, but I think you're right from what I remember. Like, there was it's a little uneven as far as the production, necessarily quality, but amount for each one. Yeah,
but it's like, yeah, it was yeah, it's, you know, a decision, I don't know, of each director to say, well, I'm gonna do this, you know, I'm not thinking about just doing the things by the book and with the budget that they gave me, but I'm trying to just be, you know, do these spectacular things, so it's going to be a calling card for people to notice my work. You know, it's fine. I mean, it's okay. It is what it is.
Yeah. And going back to what you said a minute ago about the different mediums, you know, short form versus long form and things like that, I definitely understand what you're saying there, too, because there are some people who struggle with... let's say they're elevator pitches. You know, you get some people where you ask them, so what's your thing about? And the first thing they do is go, it's like, take a deep breath, right? Because, you know, they're going to launch into, you know, a long conversation. And
yeah, I feel personally attacked.
You don't do that. You don't take it to that extreme, but you know, there's also a balance. I mean, you can have people who are really good at short form, and then some people who need a trilogy to tell the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's
all depends on the story.
Yeah. Which is also interesting when you go into editing too, because, you know, that's sometimes, I don't want to say fights break out, but you've got, you know, people with different tastes. Some people say you could cut this, and somebody else was, but I want to leave it because it builds the, you know, tension, or it does this other thing, you know.
Absolutely. I try to be, you know, very, when I'm editing, I'm trying to be, you know, very detached of the previous processes.
You kind of have to be. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, so you edit your own films, or you don't have like a separate editor?
Here's the thing. Sometimes, you know, I love working with editors, but it can be, you know, making independent films, it can be very tricky. You know, what happened to me in a couple of projects was like, you know, if I have to edit with somebody, I need to be like, you know, in their studio for like a month maybe, which means, you know, I have to
it's time
you know, be available on their schedule, you know, go to their studio, you know, and everything that comes with it in terms of, you know, it can seem a petty type of idea, but it's like it demands some, you know, money and resources and things different than I edit in my own house or in my own studio.
Yeah.
And I can decide when, you know, I have a deadline, of course, but I can decide when I do it.
Yeah.
I don't have to be, you know, moving to anywhere else.
Yeah. You can't exactly go knock on your friend's door at like, you know, 2 a.m. Whereas if you're doing your own editing, if you wake up in the middle of the night, you have a great idea, then you can just go to it.
You can try. Absolutely. And you can still work maybe in some other stuff and just put this on the other hours where you're not, you know, whatever. So I, you know, that was one thing that really was, you know, motive for me to edit some of my stuff. But also, you know, as much as I love working with editors, sometimes it's, you know, much faster for me to actually just do it myself.
Do yourself, yeah.
Just I know what I want. I don't have to explain it and go through, you know, some process that might be very good and helpful, but in other cases it can be just, you know, just slower. I don't know, but I love the editing process, and I love the
love might be a strong word for me.
no, you know, but there's something beautiful.
It can be fun.
There's something beautiful there. I mean, in finding the way to tell the story in the more, you know, the most precise way, not just, you know, abusing, because there's a lot of editors also right now that are really not editors, that are just people who can use a program like Final Cut or whatever it is, or Premiere, or, you know, whatever, and they use the program, but they don't have a very strong concept of how the film should be edited, and concepts that I had to explain. You know, I had some, you know, doing television and doing stuff like that, I had to have conversations with many editors, telling them, you know, the point of view of the character is like the most important thing to edit a scene, and to show them, you know, a Brian De Palma a scene to you know, tell them what I'm talking about. Like, you know, you have the, you know, one of the best to try to explain that to somebody is the staircase scene in The Untouchables, where you don't have a single shot that doesn't go through the eyes of Kevin Costner. Kevin Costner always, like, he always comes back to Kevin Costner's face, mostly in the build up, to do whatever, you know, to cut to whatever he cuts. Like, there's not a time where, well, I already know that the clock is there and the stairs are here and the lady coming with the baby thing is there, so I can cut directly to those places. No, always is through Kevin Costner. He's gonna look there, you're gonna see the baby, he's gonna go from there to there, and you're gonna see the clock, and he's gonna, and he does this all the time. Like, he never skips Kevin Costner once. Maybe that's, you know, a bit too much, but it's a great example of building through the eyes of the character. It's not just things that happen because somebody is watching them, somebody is participating.
Yeah. And was it all, I think I heard that right, but was it like not all his POV either, but it was just staggering back and forth between shots of his point of view and then someone looking at him. So that, yeah, like you said, there's no breaking up of the scene with just a static shot of something else. It's always either him looking at something or something looking at him.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting. That's a great, I don't say that all scenes should be edited like that, but that's a great example of, okay, so, you know, sometimes these kind of editors that don't have much concept are going through just the scene just because of the rhythm or whatever, and they it starts something that is like, you could put this shot here or there or before or after, but then when you have somebody that is looking, it's going through these scene, that kind of gives a more specific order to why you decide that this shot should go here and not there, and, you know, whatever.
Okay,
it's like connective kind of tissue.
It's very popular. Yeah,
that, or I was thinking it's like composing. Like when you put it that way, you know, it sounds like there can be some fun to editing.
Well,
because it's almost like composing music.
It's funny that you say that, because the other thought that was in my mind is, as a musician, you know, there's a difference between playing two notes and then sliding from one note to the next. You know.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
Tell me about these posters behind you.
Yeah, I was wondering about those too.
Oh man, these posters. I actually left them today because I was going to change them yesterday at the end of the month, but I said no, I'm gonna hold them one more day. So I have them on my background. Like, it, you probably don't realize the actual size, so I'm gonna step next to them.
Nice.
They're huge.
Yes.
Oh, those are huge.
They're huge.
Okay.
I'm not.
See.
Yeah, I'm not a small person. Those are.
And they're not directly behind you. Like, it was like,
no.
Oh, okay.
No,
those,
that's
oh.
What it looked like. Those are the Italian 4Fs. They're called. They're like the size of four posters.
Ah.
Yeah, it's a size that I love so much, and I had to build like this thing with magnets, so I can exchange them. Yeah, and I can exchange them. And for some people, it's like, well, but you can see the lines of the connects. Like, I love that. I don't need them to be like completely pressed or anything.
Yeah,
and I keep changing them. Yeah, like once a month or every couple of months.
Nice.
And now I have these wonderful two posters for Miss 45, obviously. I have other, you know, all of the Miss 45 memorabilia that I have it hanging here, like the Draft House Films poster, some stills, some other stuff. Yeah, but this is the Italian, the big Italian poster. And the other from a film that I discovered like 5-6 years ago when I crazy about, which is Report to the Commissioner, which is a 1970s thriller that it's absolutely amazing. I kind of knew about it. I saw the poster. It's beautiful.
Interesting.
Yeah, but then I saw the film and I was blown away by it. I've seen the film like 5 or 6 times already because I really thought, yeah, I think it's like it's a really underappreciated thriller of the 70s.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm very amused that the light from the I'm guessing it's a flashlight that he's holding, looks like it's pointing directly to where the light is above your head.
Yeah.
So it works perfectly.
Yeah, the lens flare lines up with it. It's nice.
The lens flare aligned with that. I don't know how.
J.J. Abrams eats your heart out.
Great. Yeah.
What was the name of the second film? It was Miss 45, and the other one was
Report to the Commission.
Report to the Commission, that's right.
Yeah, it's 1976, I think it is.
Okay.
Wonderful, wonderful film with an amazing score by Charles Bernstein, I think it is. Elmer Bernstein, I'm sorry. Yeah, not Charles Bernstein, the composer of The Entity, Elmer Bernstein.
Okay.
Wonderful, wonderful soundtrack.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We've got
really nice movie.
We got a couple people here who have joined us in chat. I know you can't see it. They haven't asked any questions, but just wanted to say hello and let them know. By the way, if you have any questions for Adrian that you'd like us to ask, please drop them in the chat so we can do so.
Yeah.
What else is going on? Well, speaking of,
I'm working on tons of projects right now. I'm doing lots of stuff. Awesome. But I'm also very excited now to, you know, try to figure out, you know, the way, like I was talking about the editing process, like just trying to find out ways of making movies that, you know, kind of break from the from what we see in the you know, content as content.
Mm. Yeah, a little bit out of the ordinary, a little something original.
Yeah. And I'm excited that I feel like in the past few years there were a bunch of films in the horror genre that have been like kind of, you know, trying to break with the mm-hmm. you know, regular
of yours or someone else
structures of no of other people,
just in general, like,
just in general, yeah, like films that have been breaking with that type of structure, like mm-hmm. you know, I would say the two films by Craig Seger, you know, the Barbarian and Weapons, really exciting.
Mm-hmm. I still have questions favorites. About Weapons. What does the 217 mean? What is it?
I know. Who knows?
Maybe we'll find out in shit, what the hell was her name? The aunt? Jesus. Gladys. Maybe we'll find out in Gladys' prequel movie.
Oh. Hopefully. No, I mean, it's it's great that you have you know, big movies that are crazy, that have all these crazy ideas. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That they're going for that. Like there was a moment I feel in the past decade. I will not take it against James Wan, because I think James Wan is amazing. But I think that in the post James Wan era, the you know, the genre was moving towards a very conventional structure and a very conventional type of, you know, just having these kind of blends of, you know, family drama and, you know, with, yeah, very, very superficial family drama, I would say. And, you know, horror elements that were very, very conventional. And now I feel like we're moving somewhere else. We're moving to a place that I find very interesting, because I feel like, you know, for all of us who grew up watching horror films, you know, I think one of the most wonderful things about watching films, for me, watching horror films in the 80s, in the early 90s, was like those films were very unpredictable. Mm. You know, you didn't feel like you knew exactly what was coming. Even though, you know, here's the thing. When you see a film like Scream, it looks like all of the slashers of the 80s were like super predictable and the structure was the same for all of them. And I disagree with that, because when you watch many of them, it's like you don't even know who is going to survive in many of them. It's like the one who survives is just that guy. It's like it's not even like very prepared. It's like it's there's not a big. When you see Scream, you see like, oh well, you know, Neve Campbell is the protagonist of the film, clearly, so she's going to survive. But in many of these films, it was like that woman that was in the background, that girl that appeared in two scenes. Mm-hmm. Well, she's the only one left now. Okay, so she's you know, okay, and maybe we can say, yeah, well, she's the one who didn't have sex or whatever, you know, other rules that
final girl's gotta be pure.
But still, it was like there was something that anything, you felt like anything could happen with many of those films. And I think that we lost that for many years. Like, a lot of rules and a lot of, you know, structures and things were applied. And, you know, they became more conventional. I feel horror films became more conventional. And now we're going, you know, again towards that. A place where, you know, they can be more surprising.
Mm-hmm. I think that I suspect that what you're talking about there about things being more predictable is more of maybe a mainstream thought process. But I think that's for two reasons. Number one, if they're not looking at a franchise for example, Friday the 13th and go from, you know, the first one to the second one to the third one. They're not comparing those. What they're doing is they're comparing, number one, with all the copycats, right? Mm. And so it becomes an unfair comparison because the copycats aren't necessarily trying for the same level of quality as the top of the class, because they're just in it for the money. They're just trying to make a movie that somebody comes and buy a ticket. And then the other issue with it too is that from a mainstream audience, like when you were talking about trying to guess who survives, mainstream audiences don't go to a horror movie and try to guess who survives. Like, that's not even their concept. They're just like, what's going to happen? Who's going to die?
Do they not know about Final Girl? They don't know the formula?
I would bet. I mean, there
are every one of these fuckers needs to go watch Cabin in the Woods now if they don't. I mean, look, there's the jock, there's the nerd, there's the slut, there's the, and then the final.
Speaking as someone who feels like also. So speaking as someone who is, I know that I am not as much of a horror fan as many other people who are horror fans.
Okay.
You know, I am aware of some of the rules, particularly the ones laid out in Scream. But, for example, until I heard them said in Scream, I don't know that I had even been conscious of some of them. Like, yes, I knew about no sex, no drinking, no drugs. I'm trying to think what some of the other ones are that I picked up from that. But, like, even the concept of a final girl, I didn't think about that. Like, that entire idea didn't enter into my brain until years into the, 2000s? And I watched Freddy and, you know, Jason in the 80s. So for me to go 20 years without even having the concept of what a final girl is in my head, I do think that mainstream audiences miss a lot of they're not making the same type of comparisons that a horror fan would.
I guess. It's hard to tell these days because, you know, I mean, the mainstream audience more and more every day is becoming more a horror fan. Horror is a lot more mainstream than, in a good way, than it was back in like the 80s, 90s, even the early aughts. But to your point about, you know, not even knowing who the final girl or, you know, the predictability of horror movies that say Scream seems to say is like, I think it's because maybe like it's going off of the big ones from those eras, the Friday the 13th, the Nightmare on Elm Street, the Halloweens. And those did kind of follow that
trope pattern,
not trope, but that pattern, that configuration, if you will, where you have, you know, your Don't Fuck in the Woods. The pure girl is the one who's going to live in the end. I'm sorry, I cursed. I don't know if we're allowed to.
No,
but, I think the thing is, it's not all horror movies, because you have your indies and your hidden gems, like things like The Prowler.
And that's what I was saying.
Deathline, like,
but the mainstream audience wouldn't even be aware to watch those.
And I think that there's you know, on that type of classification that Scream makes. With, you know, I love Scream. I don't have anything against it, but I think
there's
it was
a new one out. You know,
I lost interest really fast with these last three. Like, I saw only the first one of these three, and I was like, that's
actually I recently did watch the new ones myself. I'd only seen like 1 through 3, I think, and they're not bad. They kind of, I think, redo the vibe of the original with a bit of a new twist, but you do have to take your grain of salt. It's a Scream movie.
Yeah, it's a sequel. I don't know, but my point is that, you know, I think that there was something, like, it was more of a stunt to put this set of rules and everything and tell them as if they were like the truth. Yeah. But I'm not entirely sure that really worked for most of those films, because one thing that happened after those rules were set was that a lot of people started to think that slasher films were, how do you say that, kind of prude, or they were kind of, you know, trying to say, don't have sex, because if you have sex, this is what happens.
Okay.
And I think that's the opposite of what what slasher movies were. They were exploitation movies, if they were something, you know, or they were making fun of the exploitation as Slumber Party Massacre did, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very free, and they were very very confrontational. I think also against the censorships, because you know there was a lot of people in the 80s that were, you know, against these type of movies, against their violence, their portrayal of, you know, sexuality or whatever.
Was it Video Nasty era over in Britain?
Yeah, of course.
There was a whole movement against horror movies.
So to me, to say when these films were like very, you know, against having sex out of wedlock, you know, or whatever, it's like, I think that's really silly. It's misunderstanding the point.
Mm-hmm. No, if anything, like, I think one of the things that comes up on our podcast often is the interest in horror is like the allure of the taboo, and that's what a horror movie is doing with the inclusion of sex in the woods, and the people who are having sex in the woods getting killed is you want it. It's like advertising it, like you want to be involved in both things, the sex and the horror, because it's or not so much the taboo angle, but maybe
titillating.
Like titillating, but also contained fear, contained terror that you can experience and is a safe way. So in that way, the movie wants you to be part of the horror and the violence, and like it's like you're putting yourself in the shoes or in the head of the person who's being attacked and the person who's having sex. So yeah, they're pro-sex. That or the entire horror industry is run by an underground Christian organization that wants everybody to get promise rings. I don't, you know, maybe it's that. Maybe.
As the meme says, ¿por qué no las dos?
¿Por qué no las dos?
Yeah.
I love that.
Sell tickets to both parties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's see. No questions. Oh, also think earlier movies, including that was a different kind of horror for parents, especially. This is what your kids are doing. Yeah. This is what might happen because of it.
Yeah, that's another angle of it. Like, horrific experience for kids for parents putting them through the horror of what it's 11 p.m. Do you know where your kids are?
Yes and no. I mean, every parent who is, like, for you to have kids means you've had sex. So, like, there's only so much, how can I say this? Yeah, unless you've got a prudish parent. Parents know that their kids, especially teens, are going to start getting into that. But, you know, maybe the fear of, you know, there being serial killers is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I was a parent and seeing movies about my kids doing something like that, I would be less concerned about the drug use or the sex and more concerned about, you know, potential danger. But again, that's just me. I'm sure that there are other parents.
Thinking realistically. You can't think realistically in horror. It's not fun.
I mean, about the fears that parents might have watching these movies and thinking about how that's interacting with their kids. But what I was about to say is, but that's just me. I'm sure there are plenty of parents out there who would see that and be like, no, I don't want my kids having sex or involving themselves in drugs or alcohol either. That ties in with, yes, Satanic Panic. She just said it in the chat too. That all ties together.
That's
such an interesting era, really.
Still is. It's becoming more and more interesting by the decade, really.
Well, the other interesting thing about it is you think about like the different genres and how what we were afraid of in a particular era, we then make fun of later when we realize that the reality wasn't as bad as we thought it would be. You know, and that's coming around in things like, you know, Scary Movie and stuff like that. Although, the other flip side of that is, you know, with serial killer stuff, realizing that actually no, it's worse than we thought it was. You know, there's a lot more stuff going on out there that they don't even tell us because they're afraid to not have copycats and stuff like that. So
mm-hmm.
yeah But you know, but a thing that really I'm interested in, and you know, I would like to share this concern with you about, is, you know, that I feel like for some reason that we're still kind of, I mean, there are a lot of things to be afraid right now, this era, this moment the world is going through, but it seems like there's something that it's like we seem to be kind of frozen in references and things. Mostly, I would say, from the 80s, maybe even the early 90s, and that's about it. Like, there's, like, it concerns me that, you know, I don't see a lot of, you know, people, like, trying to bring things that, you know, from the early 2000s or something like that. It's like, all the references and all the things that I was seeing, like the Faces of Death trailer that was out a couple of days ago, and I was like, why? That's a question. but like the title is good. I mean, it's like it's okay. I can get that, but it's like we're going back again to the 80s, or you know, that was, I don't know if late 70s or early 80s.
Late 70s, early 80s, I think, yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, to me, it's very interesting, because when I think of when I was growing up, like when I was a kid in the 80s, like to me, the things that were like close to me were like the 70s movies and the 80s movies. Like right now, thinking that the references are like from films like that, 40 or even 50 years old, it's mind-boggling to me. Like, I imagine that in the 80s, and it's like watching, you know, almost like the Universal classics, you know, or the horror films of the 40s, and it's like that.
That's
to me, that was
sobering,
like,
thought.
That was like such an old thing. Like, I can't imagine, you know.
But I mean, they were there, and you, like, didn't know it.
No, and I could watch them. You know, I was a kid that, you know, my parents were very, you know, big cinephiles. I would watch black and white movies. I would watch, you know, all kinds of movies. I'm not saying no, but it was like, that wasn't the, you know, something that I felt like it was kind of close to me. But then I watch, you know, I went the other day to see the Hot Bloody Affair on, you know, on the theater, the Kill Bill, you know, Hot Bloody Affair.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. That's right. They did both of them at the same time. How long was that? There was an intermission, right?
4.5 hours. Wow. 4.5 hours. And, yeah, plus the intermission, right? So it's almost a 5-hour experience in theater. I went twice, right?
Oh, God.
The theater was packed.
Once wasn't enough for you.
But the funny thing, I was watching the film, and I was like, I mean, this is like the most modern thing you can imagine. Now, I'm not saying that there are no great films made today. I don't want to sound like I'm bitter or no. There are great films being made today, but this looks pretty much like anything that, you know, it could be a film that was released 2 weeks ago. You know what I mean? It's like that they made it this year. It's like, I feel like there is not a lot of evolution, I would say, on how the films look, where they take the references from, and that's I don't know what it is. But that's the way I feel. Like,
it's because they're all using red cameras. They all look the same.
That's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons, maybe. Yeah, but I don't know what it is. But there's also, like, you know, pulling from references from the 80s or the 90s, or, you know, it's like we're all looking to the same place and trying to kind of do things that, you know, some are great, but it's like you're kind of watching over and over again.
I think that's going to get better over time, though, because One of the things that I've noticed, so over the last year, I've been going and doing research on a lot of different horror movies to build a database of trivia questions for a game that we're going to put together. And so I've been researching from 1920 all the way to current day. And there's definitely been an increase in the number of, you know, popular horror movies that have been coming out. Obviously, since the 1920s, there was not many, but, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, until today, there are a lot more movies coming out today. And I think that, it, you know, as we approach or move into the future, there's going to be a wider, what's the word I'm looking for? There's going to be more different things that they can pull references from, whereas if you're making a movie today, you have a narrower range of things to pull from, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. Like, kind of, but yeah. So, like, what Adrian was saying a moment ago about the time frame difference in between, you know, '80s and '70s were 40 and 50 years ago now, and it almost seems like we've kind of like latched on to the references and style of the '80s and '90s, and not a lot of movies coming out today will reference something 10 or 20 years older because that's like 2000s and odds. I don't know, they didn't really have like their own kind of vibe, because at that point we were still kind of latching on to the 80s and 90s. So it's like, as far as references in the vibe, it's been stuck on 80s, 90s for a while now.
Yeah.
Counter to that, like we said, as we go on further in time, there will be more references, I hope. But hey, the 2020s are shaping up to have a really good vibe and references. We're going to have some things to look back on when we get to the 2030s.
Or not?
No. I don't want to sound pessimistic. I think that it's more like, okay, there are a bunch of, you know, amazing films being made.
Oh yeah. I wasn't saying that in a negative light. I like the fact that we're hanging on to the 80s, 90s vibe. It's
but
cool.
That's the thing. It's like, to me, there's like, you know, the way I feel, but I don't know if this is just me. Like, I feel like there was an evolution in the way that movies could be told and could look.
Yeah.
We kind of got to a point where that we're kind of stalled on that point.
Right. And like the production and the appearance of films has been kind of the same.
Yeah. And in terms of references, we're kind of stalled in a previous era. You know, like, I think that a film that it's made from 2005 to now doesn't really, you can't really tell much, you know.
Yeah, you can't differentiate them.
You can't differentiate much as you would in a, you know, in 85, I would watch a film from 65, The Sound of Music, and that would look like a film of the 60s. Like, that didn't look like, oh, it was made yesterday. That looked like a 60s film. You know what I mean? It's like, right now, it's like, you got to a point where it kind of stalled, and in terms of references, I think it's even previous, you know, in terms of of the themes, in terms of, you know, a lot of ideas. But I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm just thinking that probably movies got to a different stage that probably happened to other arts that were evolving for, you know, 100, 200 years, and then got to a point where, well, now it's kind of, it's going to be these from now on. You know,
yeah, look at like variations. Civilization empires. Some are short, some are long.
Yeah. Well, listen, we've got about 3 minutes left. Gmail is pinging me a notification here. I guess we should probably find some way to close this off. I was looking on our Horror Makes Us Happy webpage, your bio page. I don't have any links here for you, but I know I've got at least your Instagram page. I could probably throw a link to that on here. If there's any other links that you'd like us to link to, let us know, and we can add that to the Horror Makes Us Happy bio page. For anybody who might find this later, just go to horrormakesushappy.com, go to episodes, and Adrian is the second bullet on the list. And also go check out his interview that we did. Actually, it's on the bio page. There's a link to that, too.
Yeah.
And what have you got coming out that you want to promote?
Yeah.
Talking to a Stranger, my new film. It's going to be on festivals, and hopefully will have a US release, you know, later this year. We're still working on that, but yeah, hopefully you will see, you will enjoy this film.
Cool.
Yeah, if you get it on any kind of streaming service, I will keep an eye out for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a bunch of other stuff coming, but this is like the new thing.
Okay. That's cool. We will look forward to it.
Yeah.
So, everybody in chat, thank you for joining us. Like, share, subscribe, tell a friend, Patreon, all that fun stuff. And we'll look forward to what you got coming out.
Thank you so much, guys. It was a pleasure.
It was great chatting with you.
A pleasure.
Hey,
cheers. Bye-bye.